right? You're listening to the History Workshop website at www.historyworkshop.org.uk. We're with Beatrix Campbell and we're talking about the film Made in Dagenham. Did you enjoy it?
Well, as a friend of mine put it beautifully, I loved it and I hated it. I hated some of the bits that were trying to get at a kind of raunchy working class culture in the neighbourhood, in Dagenham, around where our heroines lived. I also hated some of the strategic decisions by the filmmakers to make what they wanted, obviously, we understand this, a popular movie. So it's got a lot of, it's got a bit of sex in it, and it's got a bit of this and that and the other, which I think are a bit rubbishy. However, that said, I think it's a great thing that they did it and made it. It's a great thing to have honoured that strike, this remarkable strike. And what is really terrific in the film is a sense of this really robust, funny, witty, imaginative group of women, kind of on their own, who absolutely terrified some of the most powerful corporate capitalist men on earth. And that's just great to behold. And it also serves as a very smart reminder of just how hard people had to work and how hated your average factory worker was by their bosses.
But the film shows the machinists, the 187 women who went on strike for equal pay, as defeating or winning over their own menfolk, the company and the union bureaucracy. Now, this does strike you as a little bit of a myth.
It is a myth because they never won. They never got what they really wanted. And what they wanted was to be graded within this labyrinthine grading structure in the car industry. They wanted to be graded as skilled workers because they were, well, semi-skilled workers, because they were, in their view, and everybody would acknowledge it, skilled. They were the sewing machinists who made the car seats, the covers for the car seats. And the fascinating thing about the movie is that it's revealed how the entire shebang depended upon them. Well, they were extremely irate because, quite rightly, because a new deal had been struck between the unions and the bosses, a new grading structure, and there they were at the bottom. So their first really dramatic sense of being affronted is that they were at the bottom of a pay scale. And their grievance, which is endlessly not resolved, was that they wanted to be regraded somewhere in the middle as semi-skilled workers. Now, that didn't get sorted then. It didn't get sorted for another 17 years, and it took another strike in the 1980s to get that resolved. The deal that emerges in the movie is a different deal. It wasn't what they went on strike for. It was not insignificant, but it wasn't what they wanted. And this is very important, because these were women who I think were never understood. They were never understood by their own unions, even the best of the shop stewards and conveners who sympathised with them. Some of them even empathised with them. They certainly weren't understood by the trade union hierarchy. And I don't think they were really, and probably it's still true, really understood by your average male trade union activist. And the reason is that what these women wanted sorting out was everything. For the men, what trade unionism was about was money and their place in an industrial hierarchy that carried with it certain rewards, or not, but because of the kind of baroque law of trade union bargaining and the way that work was organised and valued, these women had to fit themselves into a set of protocols, procedures and beliefs that didn't really allow them to fully express what it is that they wanted sorting out as women who went to work.
There's one scene in the film where the women strikers go to lobby a trade union conference. As far as you can make out, their union conference, and there isn't a single woman delegate present in the hall. Again, is that an oversimplification or is that as it was?
I don't think it's an oversimplification at all. Let's not forget, the construction of the car industry, the invention of the car industry, coincides with a really determined movement amongst organised men to get women out of industry. They'd been more or less successful by the First World War. Women got back into industrial work in the First World War. They're back out again in the interregnum between the two world wars. And in the 1930s, there's a more or less successful crusade within the trade union movement, either to get women out entirely or to get married women out. And this was all reinforced by an ideological approach to what wages were, which had been established with the formation of the trade union movement in the form that we know it now in the 1870s and 1880s. And that was that men should be breadwinners, they should control access to the great new industries, which are, you know, the crucible of capitalism, and that their wage should be a family wage that maintains a dependent wife whose sole function in life is to take care of men and children. Now, that ideology prevailed up until the 1970s. It may prevail still in the minds of some people, but it certainly prevailed at the time that these women went on strike over their grading issue. So the trade union movement itself, in its formative years, had engaged in a historic compromise with capitalism to defend its own interests at the expense of women, and that has defined the history of British trade unionism really for most of its life.
And you have Barbara Castle in the film, shown as a wily political operator, a political insider, but basically rooting for the women.
In her heart, and in some of her head, she understood the women. I don't know that she ever particularly rooted for them. What she certainly knew was that during the Second World War, when a national royal commission set up on equal pay and women workers, that the Labour government, after the end of the Second World War, refused to implement it, the recommendation for some limited concessions on equal pay, and the Trade Union Congress in, I think, about 1947, decided that equal pay for women would be inappropriate, and both of them agreed that the national network of children's nurseries should be abolished. And that's a defining moment because it happens at the point at which the modern welfare state was constructed in Britain, the point at which the working class, the organised working class, in a sense, is felt to be a force that deserves to be answered, must be answered, and was answered with the creation of the welfare state. Women are completely marginalised in that history. They're not just marginalised, they're absolutely defeated. So by the time the Ford women go on strike, that's the context within which they have to manoeuvre. So trade union events, trade union congresses, conferences of the medley of unions organising in Fords would have been all men, wouldn't have been unusual. And for them to enter would have been like, well, entering a very inhospitable environment that found these women bewildering.
Do you remember the Ford women's strike at the time?
I remember it vividly because this was 1968. Everybody was fascinated by strikes all over Europe, sit-ins, the most glorious kind of theatres of resistance. And here was something, in the British context, somewhat surprising. These were working class women who were having a go, asserting something kind of shattering. We hadn't had.
But did it feel shattering at the time, though?
It felt extraordinary, spectacular, gorgeous. It also felt odd, in the sense that much of the kind of riotous assembly and glorious revolutionary activity of 1968 invited support. It was often organised in ways that were very open, very egalitarian, no closed doors, people could wander in and out of them. That wasn't true of this strike. It was somewhat shut, actually, and it was specific to that group of 187 women whose voice was mediated by these massively powerful and influential trade unions who were very worried about what these women were on about, and maybe even as worried as the employers were.
And the film suggests a tangential link between some of the women and what was happening with women's fashion, with what was happening in Carnaby Street, what was happening in the pop scene and the festival culture. Again, an artifact of the film or something that had some sort of touch on reality?
More of an artifact than it probably was, although I have to say one of the very moving bits in the movie was the domestic lives of the women who worked at Ford's, ranging from somebody living in a little bungalow with the garden and the peeling conservatory or shed walls and windows to a woman living in a what would have been a brand new, fabulous flat with fabulous wallpaper and, you know, you can just picture it, Mary Quant kind of written all over it, and the kind of furniture that I remember my mother proudly acquiring out of this kind of longing to be modern. So undoubtedly, it shows popular working class culture's connection to modernity and its pleasure in style. Where I think it gets it slightly wrong is in the individual representations of some of the women whose, I don't know, Carnaby Street-esque-ness is probably exaggerated.
And you came across some of the Ford women machinists, what, a decade or so later?
I went to see them in about, I reckon it must have been about 1976. By then, I was a young reporter. At 1968, I was a sub-editor on the Morning Star, which used to be the Daily Worker.
And was that sympathetic to the women?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
At that time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I say absolutely. Yes, absolutely, because this was a newspaper that supported rank-and-file action. Communists were associated with the rank and file of trade unions rather than the trade union hierarchy, although there was a presence in the trade union hierarchy.
But was it a feminist party at that time?
Oh, no. No. But it did have a powerful... No, it wasn't at all powerful. It had a persistent women's wing who organised, which organised amongst women like these and which was anchored in the life of British factories, and the newspaper itself had a vigorous women's page that later did become feminist. By the time I became a reporter, which was in the early 70s, the women's page was undoubtedly feminist and had been very strongly affected by the women's liberation movement, and some of us who were active in the women's liberation movement really used that as a space for feminist ideas and feminist activism. Now, the thing that really got me to them in the end was around about 1976, two things were striking in my head. One was that these women still hadn't got what they wanted. This was a year, 2 years after the implementation of the Equal Pay Act, and they still hadn't got what they wanted, which was to be regraded. They didn't initially go out and strike for equal pay. And the second thing that was important was that the whole environment of trade unionism in Britain had been changed by the social contract, which was a deal between the trade union movement, primarily the Transport and General Workers Union and the Engineering Union, two left-wing unions, a deal struck with the new Labour government to introduce an approach to national wage bargaining that prioritised the low-paid, overwhelmingly women, and aspects of what was called the social wage. And in other words, it was a way of expanding what trade union bargaining was about and trying to come to some kind of historic deal with the Labour government that wasn't based on the most powerful and the most privileged within the labour market and trade unions, but the majority. And so the combination of the Equal Pay Act, the first phase of the social contract that was a flat rate across the board, £3 deal for everybody, which meant that low-paid women's wages really increased significantly. And then a very interesting manoeuvre within the trade union movement at Ford's in 1976 to produce a really radical and imaginative annual claim that was interested in access to education, It was interested in pensions. It was interested in time off. It was interested in thinking about what the needs were of, by then, a very cosmopolitan workforce, some of whom came from India, some of whom came from the Caribbean. The traditions of a short summer holiday for British workers didn't suit them ever, really, given their commitments to faraway places. And so it was really fashioned around what that labour force's needs were. And so I thought, this is the time to go and see these women and find out what their stake in this claim is. What would their priorities be? Why haven't they still got what they wanted? What do they think about anything? And when I went to see them on the way down, I was talking to a convener. He said, oh, they're great, these women. They're great. They're militant. They're great, but, you know, I don't know. I don't know. You'll see, he said. And in the context of the conversation, I did see. First of all, what was terribly important, and most important of all to these women, was control over their time, because they were managing massive demands on their time in a way that applied not at all to the men. These were women who were taking care of men and children and a paid job that was sculpted around the needs of a breadwinner who was entirely taken care of by somebody else, namely his wife. Well, these were these wives. And thus the idea of a 40-hour week, 45-hour, 50-hour week that was based on daytime working just was quite inconvenient for them. What they wanted was control over their own time. They wanted facilities at work that meant that the polarisation between the neighbourhood they lived in, and indeed worked in, and their place of paid work wasn't so extreme and absolute. Why didn't you have washing machines, for instance, at work? Why couldn't you get your groceries sorted out at work? They were interested in all of that stuff. Well, as you might imagine, none of that stuff found expression in trade union annual claims or in the kinds of things that bosses and workers bargained about. Not at all.
Do you think the women would like the film?
I think they do like the film because it gives them their place in history, because it shows what they were up against. In my conversations with them, they're very clear, and they are saying the same things. They say over and over again something which really amounts to a lament. They said, you know, the men didn't support us, but we always supported them in their strikes. But they didn't support us. They didn't like it. And that's a terrible wound for working class women who gave their support to working class politics and trade union politics. And that gesture and that commitment was never reciprocated. And it still isn't, even in the moment that movie has been made.
Beatrix Campbell, thank you very much.